ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts. Hey, guys, it's Pablo here. Welcome to Super Bowl week. Yes, we've all made it. We're kicking off our coverage this week by revisiting our episode with Seth Wickersham from August. And it's an episode we did about Matthew Stafford. And it happens to be a detailed and intimate portrait of how the quarterback made his way from Detroit to Los Angeles. And then, at the end, we'll bring you a new update from Seth in the present day that brings this story so close to full circle. It is Monday, February 7th. This is ESPN Daily.
Why did you feel like the Rams were the right fit for you?
You know, looking at it in the short term there, it was really exciting just based on their recent past success. You know, it had been a bunch of years in the playoffs, a bunch of years with winning records. Once the trade happened and it was decided that I was going to be there, I wanted to make sure that I was pulling my weight.
When the Los Angeles Rams traded for Matthew Stafford this offseason, they handed one of the NFL's biggest arms to one of its biggest brains, head coach Sean McVay. And while Stafford in Detroit was pretty easy to overlook on account of the general awfulness of the Lions, there is no ignoring the quarterback now. Not in Hollywood, not when nothing short of a Super Bowl, which will be hosted in LA this postseason, would disappoint. Today, Seth Wickersham takes us behind the scenes of how the Stafford trade went down, what it all says about quarterbacks in the modern era, and how Cabo, apparently, is the nexus of power in the NFL. I'm Pablo Torre, and this is ESPN Daily. So, Seth, I've summoned you here today because you've written this cover story on Matthew Stafford, who I have now learned likes to be called Matthew and not Matt, a mistake I've been making for years and years now. And it got me to thinking that I really don't understand anything, actually, about Matthew Stafford or his interior monologue, what he's actually like, but you do, because you spent all this time with him and his wife and his new coach, Sean McVay. What did you learn about who Matthew Stafford is as he prepares to take over this franchise as the new star in LA?
I think that Matthew Stafford is, in a lot of ways, the most famous, least known quarterback in the NFL.
Seth Wickersham has covered the NFL for ESPN for 20 years.
And he's kind of been in this irrelevant franchise his entire career. You know, the only way it could have been worse if he had like been drafted by the Jets. And I think there's a lot of football fans who have never seen Matthew Stafford in his 12 years in the NFL play a complete game.
No.
Not because of injuries, even though he has had his share, but because he plays in a franchise that is never on primetime television except for Thanksgiving. And at one point, I asked him, what do you want out of the rest of your career? And I found his answer to be very earnest and humbling.
I just want to be successful. You know, those teams you really remember, those teams that have success, you get to make runs. And you know, whether it's playoff runs, Super Bowl runs, all that. But I play this game to try and win Super Bowls. And that's what I want to do. I would love to have the opportunity to play in that game as many times as I possibly can from here on out.
You know, you think about all of the quarterbacks who have authored their legends in the 12 years since Matthew Stafford has been in the NFL with these big playoff moments, and he has none of them. He doesn't have a signature play. And I think that he's very aware where he is in his career, and it's one of the reasons why he wanted out of Detroit.
Yeah, you ask him at one point in this piece, Seth, you talk to him and McVay about the sheer number of primetime games that are gonna be on television for the Rams. It reminds me about something that I don't really ever think about either, which is that time slot for NFL teams. Not all of these things are created equal, and the Rams are gonna be very much in the spotlight this season.
They're not only gonna be in the spotlight, but they're going to be under pressure because Matthew Stafford went to the Los Angeles Rams, engineered a trade there for one reason, and that's to play in a Super Bowl. And Sean McVay wagered his coaching career on another quarterback, the second time in a couple years now, for the chance to win a Super Bowl. And so they're not only going to be on prime time, they're going to be expected to perform on prime time.
Yeah, in your piece, Seth, you walk down this metaphorical memory lane with Matthew Stafford, and it's a ballroom in suburban Los Angeles. He's doing the thing that all like famous quarterbacks do at some point, where he signs like a million pieces of memorabilia, and you realize that this is him walking you through his football life. What was walking down that memory lane like?
It was really interesting. So I got to this hotel north of Los Angeles, and I walk into this ballroom, and there are just rows and rows and rows of memorabilia. And I walk up to Stafford, and as I got to him, he was signing University of Georgia memorabilia. We got to talk about his time in Georgia, where he started for 3 years and left Georgia kind of known as a winner, someone who had performed well in bowl games. And then he goes first overall to the Lions. They were the first winless team in the modern NFL history. They were an 0-16 team.
Right.
You know, he got to Detroit when the city was at its lowest in 2009 during the Great Recession. And I think that he took a lot of pride in his dream of delivering that franchise a Super Bowl. He showed some promise as a rookie, had a great one of the most memorable games ever on NFL films, where he blew out his shoulder and threw his fifth and game-winning touchdown pass as time expired.
Stafford takes the snap. This is going to be it. Stafford looking for somewhere to go. Sets and throws. End zone. Watch out. He touched it. That's got to be a flag. It's going to be first and goal, Lions. And Matthew Stafford is down on the field and is not getting up.
I just remember laying on the ground and hearing the timeout called, and for some reason in my head that clicked that I had a chance to come back in the game.
Stafford, last play of the game, takes the snap, rolls, throws, end zone. Touchdown, Detroit Lions! What a finish! And the Lions are an extra point away.
You know, it was the kind of moment that showed promise, that showed that he was not only going to deliver as a number one pick, but that he was a special number one pick. And he ended up leading the Lions to 3 playoff games, didn't win any of them, but they were kind of spread out and sprinkled throughout his career. And I don't think the Lions were ever able to get anything going.
Yeah, well, hold on a second here, because the Lions, Seth, they've never made a Super Bowl ever. So it's not entirely Matthew Stafford's fault, it's safe to say, on that front. But the thing about Matthew Stafford that makes people think that he can be this savior-type figure, let's be very honest about it, is his arm.
Stafford walks it all. Got it. Touchdown! What a beautiful throw by Stafford.
How would you describe his arm and what makes that thing special?
You know, I think that everything that Patrick Mahomes gets celebrated for now, throwing from off platform, the indifference to stepping into passes, shifting his arm to different angles depending on what windows are open, Matthew Stafford has been doing for 12 years. And a lot of people just don't notice it because
we didn't see it. We didn't see it in that way, Seth. Not that often, no.
Matthew Stafford is the type of wondrous arm that's allowed him to problem solve at a high level. That's a gift that's exclusive to the great arms. The ball just looks differently coming out of their hand. And that's the type of thing that Matthew Stafford has had his entire career. He's always had that blessed arm.
And the Lions, Seth, I mean, they were blessed to have that arm for as long as they did. I mean, this is the franchise that is most famous for the early retirements of its superstars, right? I mean, this is Barry Sanders retiring famously early, Calvin Johnson going to do the same. And Stafford, I think, was the guy they hoped would survive the whole Lions experience. But he's also the guy who was this quintessential winner at Georgia, as you say. So him becoming the face of a quintessential loser, what was that adjustment like for him?
I think it was horrible. One of the things we discussed was, you know, the mental gymnastics required to manufacture hope. And it was really kind of fascinating. Like, Kelly Stafford at one point told me...
His wife, Kelly, yeah.
His wife, Kelly, told me that, it's not just at the beginning of each season. It sometimes can be getting you through the week, getting you through the press conference, when you simply aren't sure that you guys, you know, have the horses to compete in the NFL.
He would have to be the guy who was always positive, always trying to keep guys, all right, we can do this, let's go. And I could imagine after continuing not to, you know, win those games, that gets hard and that gets repetitive.
Matthew just talked about, you know, blocking out the expectations, blocking out the coaches, blocking out any problems, and thinking about his teammates and the people in the huddle with him and how they're counting on him to perform and how he didn't want to let them down. Before each season, he would get to a place where he'd have her convinced that they were going to go to the Super Bowl.
Oh, no.
And he really believed it.
Oh, he expected to win it every season. You think, like, after years and years of literally putting everything on the line and not accomplishing what you want, that mentality would change, but it never did. It really didn't.
I asked him, you know, what's it like to be at home and watch the playoffs and watch these other quarterbacks author their own legends? Do you watch it? And he said, yeah, I do watch it. And it was horrible. And he's acutely aware of the perception of his career. And that's of someone who puts up a ton of yards, throws for a lot of touchdowns, occasionally commits the momentum-altering turnover, but more than anything, isn't there playing in late January and early February, as we've become accustomed to watching the great quarterbacks do.
And so with apologies, due apologies to Bobby Lane, I suppose, Stafford is arguably the greatest quarterback the Lions have ever had, right, Seth? I mean, he leads the franchise in wins, in touchdown passes, in passing yards. Those are seemingly reasons why Sean McVay might be hopeful he'd do better under his system. What has McVay been seeing in Matthew Stafford?
Well, I think that Sean McVay is a very ambitious coach. That's no surprise. And he's accomplished a lot for what he's done in his coaching career. But I think that one of the themes of the offseason that we've seen with Matthew Stafford, with the 49ers trading up to draft Trey Lance, is the limits of what you can do with a very good quarterback versus a transcendent one. And I think that towards the end of last season, obviously there were some problems between the coaching staff and Jared Goff. That's been well documented. And it left McVay open to the idea of an upgrade.
And Seth, just to clarify what that was about, it was this idea that Sean McVay is the boy genius coach, right? Like one of the offensive wizards of the modern NFL. And he had this toy, it almost sounded like sometimes, in Jared Goff, his guy that he could control to do whatever he wanted. And then in the last couple seasons in LA, that toy just seemed to break.
It's a thin line. I mean, Jared Goff did not play well in that Super Bowl against New England. And still, he threw a pass down the sideline midway through the fourth quarter to Brandon Cooks that Cooks should have caught.
Pass, caught, no! In and out of the hands of Cooks, it would have been a touchdown.
If Cooks had come down with that pass, or if they had called pass interference on it, which they could have done also, the Rams tie the game, and who knows how the game ends. Instead, Jared Goff threw the same pass on the next play, and it was intercepted. I think that smart defensive coordinators around the NFL realized that Jared Goff was a good player, but he didn't quite read defenses as well as the best quarterbacks in the NFL did. And that Sean McVay called plays designed to read the defense for him.
Mm.
And there are limits to how successful you can be in a quarterback's game when that's your best chance. And I think that one of the themes I get into with the story that I spoke about with Coach McVay is, you know, what can a truly great quarterback do? I think that when Matthew Stafford was drafted by Detroit, people thought he is the guy who is going to lead us to the promised land. He's going to take us to a Super Bowl. And as it turns out in Detroit, he learned the limits of what his ability could transcend. And now in Los Angeles, they're counting on those abilities to push them over the top and win a Super Bowl.
All right, coming up, how a vacation the Staffords took after the 2020 season wound up changing the trajectory of Matthew Stafford's entire career.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So the 2020 season has come to an end for Matthew Stafford and the Detroit Lions, and now he's considering seriously getting out of there. How did that day unfold?
So the Lions season ended with a loss to the Vikings that was similar to many losses during Matthew Stafford's career, in which he both played well, throwing three touchdowns, and came up just short.
Stafford throws, incomplete. Vikings finish with a win, their seventh consecutive win over the Detroit Lions.
You know, he misfired on a two-point conversion that would have tied the game. After the game, he decided that he wanted out, and he told Kelly that he wanted out, and then he was going to ask the Lions for a trade. But the next morning, he was already going back on it. Kelly walked into the kitchen, and he was emptying the dishwasher, and he was very quiet.
We had talked about it the night before, but we weren't 100% sure. And he was pretty quiet. And for Matthew, you can tell his overall mood when he's just not saying much, even around.
And he was having this entire conversation with himself where he was reconsidering, maybe deciding that he could, you know, gut through another year. But when he left that morning to go back to the facility, he asked Kelly to say a little prayer for him.
He was just kind of silent. And right before he left, he was like, all right, well, you know, wish me luck, say a prayer for me.
And he met with the Lions brass for many hours. He cried during that meeting.
You know, I wanted to make sure that whatever happened to me, the Lions got something in return for it as well. I wanted the best for both of us. And I felt at that point, the best thing for both of us was to seek a trade and try to get as much as they could for me and send me to a place that I could hopefully succeed in. You know, nothing.
And he came home knowing that he was entering his final couple weeks as a Detroit Lion, and he was nervous about it. And after a couple weeks, Kelly just said, look, we got to get out of here.
I told Matthew, he was stressing out. Obviously, there was a lot of stuff going on at this point. And I told him, we need to get away. We need to get away. We need to get out of the country. I don't care where. Away from football.
So they ended up going to Cabo. And usually what happens in Cabo stays in Cabo. But as I've learned in talking with Stafford and with Sean McVay, they cannot stop talking about what happened in Cabo.
Yeah, the Cabo thing, Seth, is this locus of really NFL power, as it turned out, over this offseason. Because there is Matthew Stafford, there is Rams offensive tackle Andrew Whitworth, a friend of Matthew's, who's also on vacation there, coincidentally. And then there also is Sean McVay, just randomly vacationing. I mean, Seth, it all feels like skullduggery, I'll be honest with you here. It all feels like this could not have possibly been accidental. But pull back the veil for us on this vacation. What was happening? How do you see that?
It was accidental. And, you know, Drew Brees was down there too. Kyle Shanahan was down there too, thinking that he might get involved in the Matthew Stafford sweepstakes.
Wait. So Cabo is just a place where NFL players sort of know to gather and possibly make moves happen.
I've always thought that you get the best NFL gossip from being at the bar at the combine late or being at the hotel bar during NFL owners meetings.
Yep.
I am going to ask our bosses to send me to Cabo for 2 weeks, and I'm just going to go to the pool and see who rolls up.
You know what? Of all the expense report schemes I've heard throughout the years, that might be the greatest now.
You You know, but Matthew landed there and he texted his friend Andrew Whitworth, who also just happens to be the Rams' offensive tackle.
Mm-hmm. You know, we landed, got to the hotel, and I told him we were staying at the place we were staying at, and if he was anywhere close, we could try and hook up and play some golf. I think he texted me back like, yeah, I'm at the pool.
Andrew Whitworth texts Sean McVay to tell him that Matthew Stafford's there. And Matthew Stafford's been in Cabo less than an hour. They all congregate at the pool, and magic happens.
Sean was sitting not too far over there, probably watching tape or something on his phone, but he was close by.
Stafford and Sean McVay just start talking intensely. And Kelly Stafford didn't even realize that that was Sean McVay. She just thought that he looked so young that he must have just been a friend of Andrew Whitworth's.
I mean, I knew of Sean. I didn't really know what he looked like at this point. I was talking to his fiance. I was like, so how do you guys know each other? And she was like, oh, well, my fiance coaches Andrew. I was like, oh!
Wait, so they all are hanging out here around this pool. How quickly does it take for this trade to get orchestrated?
Well, so McVay had heard that Stafford wanted out, and it was very quiet. And one of the things that Matthew Stafford wanted, he didn't want to play the leak game with the Lions. And so they both promised to keep this thing under the radar. The 49ers knew that Stafford wanted out. McVay had heard that Stafford wanted out and had actually watched cut-ups of him on his phone before this. And they get to talking, and McVay brings up this game from 2016. It was week 7. Sean McVay is the precocious, he's always precocious, but he was especially precocious offensive coordinator for Washington, and they're playing the Lions. And Kirk Cousins had scored a touchdown with a little over a minute left to put Washington up ahead.
He keeps it. Cousins running to the end zone, touchdown! Kirk Cousins does it with his feet!
Matthew Stafford gets the ball with 75 yards to go, and McVay brings this game up to him. And at the pool, with a couple cocktails in Matthew, Matthew goes into detail about what happened on the ensuing drive.
Then we came out, I threw a dagger to Marvin.
Here is Stafford. They do have 3 timeouts remaining. Throws over the middle, completes the pass to Marvin Jones.
Threw it to him, sidearm. He caught it, had a big play. I ran on the 2 plays later, maybe.
Stafford stepping up. Stafford's going to run. He's got the first down.
Got us about 10 or 15. Great catch on a basic from Andre Roberts. It was a huge play that nobody really talks about.
Stafford over the middle. Caught. Andre Roberts inside the 20, down to the 18.
And then I hit Anquan in the seam in 3 buzz to win it.
Stafford completes to Bolden into the end zone. Touchdown! Anquan Bolden!
And Sean McVay, in addition to having his heart broken by having to relive this, as he later told me, was absolutely blown away at Stafford's recall.
He could remember every play of that drive to go win the game. And, you know, you can see he's got a photographic memory from all the experiences. And usually when you're around these players, you know, whether it's Matthew and even just talking to Breeze a little bit when we were in Cabo, those guys, they remember these plays. It's like an inventory where they just store it in their vault.
I think that what Sean McVay wanted in his next quarterback was someone who he could look at as a partner who could use all of that experience to help take pressure off of Sean McVay in the play calls. Mm. There are some quarterbacks who simply have an innate creativity, and you can call the perfect play, but that doesn't mean that that play is going to be executed well. And one of the dirty little secrets that quarterbacks will only tell you off the record is the number of catastrophes that they have to manage for on any given play. Getting the snap, diagnosing the defense, and throwing the ball accurately to the open receiver, the stuff that we laud them for, that's the bare minimum of the play. They have to know in their head what offensive tackle or lineman can't block his man, what running back may run the wrong route, which receiver can't get open against a certain cornerback. And you have to do all of these things to manipulate the defense and account for all of these problems to find a way for the play to succeed. That's what Sean McVay was looking for in a quarterback.
There's so many things that you look at with the quarterback position, but you know, your decision making, your timing, your accuracy, the rhythm, your ability when things do break down off schedule, what does it look like having the ability to create on your own? And you know, he was checking the boxes in a big way.
And that's one of the things he was most impressed with Matthew Stafford, is that Matthew Stafford is certainly no stranger to disaster. And he watched him succeed time and time again in those moments that, you know, the game is kind of out of a coach's hands.
Well, Seth, we don't think of him as the type of quarterback that Sean McVay would look at and say to himself, oh, thank God, I don't have to read defenses for him in the way that he had to do for, say, Jared Goff.
But the coaches knew that he was the type of player who could do that, even if fans didn't. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about this. Once Matthew Stafford made it known that he wanted out of Detroit and word got around the league, there was a lot of teams that were involved. The Carolina Panthers actually offered the best deal, but he didn't want to go there. And he didn't have a no-trade clause in his contract. If the Lions wanted to send him to Carolina, they could have. His preferences were, in order, the Los Angeles Rams, the San Francisco 49ers, who were so heartbroken by not getting Matthew Stafford that I think that that's one of the reasons why they ended up trading up to draft Trey Lance, and the Indianapolis Colts. But the Rams were by far the leader in the clubhouse. And, you know, I think the organization did him a real solid by trading him there.
Yeah. So this meeting in which they're vibing out over this game that was a failure for McVay, a win for Stafford. And by the way, because you mentioned it, it does seem like somewhere in the distance, I'm now imagining Kirk Cousins also heartbroken, just like for many reasons from the pool, maybe on the other side of the beach. But that meeting pushes this deal forward. How fast did things pick up after that?
It picked up really fast to the point that, you know, even Sean McVay now has a hard time believing how fast it came together. When he learned that Matthew Stafford was in Cabo with him, he texted Rams executives, "You're not going to effing believe this, but Matthew Stafford is here." So after that meeting, he goes back to his phone. He's watching more cut-ups on Matthew Stafford, testing the patience of Veronica, his fiance, or perhaps investing in their mutual happiness, one could consider it. And he wants Matthew Stafford. And he gets on the phone with the owner, Stan Kroenke, the same owner who paid Jared Goff a ton of money.
Right.
Only a couple years earlier, and explains why Matthew Stafford is the guy that Sean thinks will lead them to a Super Bowl.
I was just explaining, you know, why I felt like he would be a good fit. Talked to him a little bit about the time that we had spent together, and you know, that trust that Mr. Kroenke makes you feel is a big reason why, you know, feeling believed in, feeling supportive is why you want to do everything in your power to make him right on some of the belief that he's shown.
And you know, Matthew Stafford was at dinner with some friends. And his phone rang.
We were at dinner and Matthew got a call, got up. I didn't even realize he left the table. Again, we were there with a bunch of friends. So just talking to them, and he came over and he was like, "Well, I guess I'm a Ram."
And the night after that, the Staffords got together with the McVays and they toasted to their joint future, and as Sean later told me, things got pretty hazy after that.
It was, you know, congratulations to the new Ram. Looking forward to a lot of fun, and let's enjoy this night. And then there was a lot of phone calls and texts and different things like that, some of which are very clear, others that got a little bit hazier the later in the night.
All right, Seth. So that haze that Sean McVay was just describing there, it's cleared, and we are back here in the present tense. I'm talking to you on a Monday, February 7th, and we're talking now 20 games and 15 wins later because Matthew Stafford and Sean McVay and the whole gang from Cabo have made it. They're here. They're about to play in Super Bowl 56 against the Bengals, and it's going to be a home game at SoFi, although technically it's a road game because of the way the NFC and the AFC just alternate that tag every year, but when you trace the trajectory of this year, what has Matthew Stafford proven to you over this season?
I think that during the season, he was Matthew Stafford. And, you know, there was moments where he was a brilliant quarterback. There was moments where he threw that momentum-killing interception. But he was always, the test for him was always going to come in January and February. And obviously he played really well in their opening playoff game against the Arizona Cardinals. On the Manning cast, Peyton Manning was talking about how, you know, once you have your first playoff win, you can cut loose a little bit.
The feeling that Stafford's going to have after this, I'm telling you, watch out for him next week, right? Because once you get that first one, right, that monkey is off Stafford's back, and he can free up and I think play even looser next week down in Tampa.
As we talked about, he wanted to test himself under the highest leveraged circumstances, and man, has he done it. You know, that ending to the Bucs game after the Rams did everything they could to blow it, and he comes through with that huge pass to Cooper Kupp.
Deep down the right side. He's got Kupp running down the hash marks. He reels it in at the 15. Cooper Kupp has the catch, tackled at the 12, puts it down in game-winning formation.
Really bad defense by Tampa, by the way, but huge pass to Cooper Kupp. And then this week, this past week against the 49ers, in the fourth quarter, 3rd-and-3, Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay have talked about this, where, look, a coach can only do so much. At some point, it's third down, the crowd's frenzied, it's a high-stakes moment. The quarterback has to be the one who gets the ball, deals with chaos, and figures it out. And Matthew Stafford figured it out.
He stands in and delivers. Cooper Kupp makes the catch, breaking across the field, breaking a tackle at the 20, and he's down at the 11. Cooper Kupp roars in celebration.
He hit Cooper Kupp on that quick slant that ends up going for a big gain deep into 49ers territory, leads to the game-winning field goal. And he's proven not only to himself that he can come up big in big games, but he's proven it to all of us as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, Seth, we're at near the end of the road, and I'm just wondering, when you consider the all-in kind of experiment that the Rams have pretty uniquely taken on here, with Sean McVay as sort of the guy who wanted to pull all of these triggers, what does it tell you about their strategy?
It tells me that it's barely worked, but it has worked. And, you know, I think that when you look at the Rams, obviously that's a team that's still trying to gain traction in LA. Those two home games against the 49ers, where the 49ers probably had more fans, even in the NFC Championship game, Matthew Stafford had to use a silent count at times.
Yes.
I mean, that's embarrassing. And there's really nothing you can do to change that, I think, other than winning a Super Bowl. And I would say the Rams are really interesting because for a lot of the year, they were not ahead in their division. Remember, the Arizona Cardinals were the ones who were starting the season undefeated and were really the setting the lead in that division. And the Rams went all in with Matthew Stafford. And then as the year went on, they went more all in. You know, they make the deal to acquire OBJ. They trade for Von Miller. And I think what was interesting about those two selections is not only that they did it, knowing that they have this window where they're hosting the Super Bowl, where they've got this quarterback, and they may not be here again. There's no guarantees in the NFL. They not only got those players, but they got them to buy into what the Rams want them to do. Obviously, at the beginning with OBJ, he and Stafford weren't on the same page. It was a little rough there. But now OBJ has essentially become this, like, Robert Woods-like, you know, dogged possession receiver. And you have Von Miller, who obviously is used to being an every down player. He's obviously played a lot with the Rams, but he is brought in for those moments at the end of the game like they had in the NFC Championship when that defensive line can turn loose against the quarterback with the game on the line. And that defensive line as a collective, it all worked. It's really amazing how well it all worked.
And so if the Rams do not win the Super Bowl, Seth, is this a failure?
That's a great question. I mean, I'd have to say that they would look at it not like a failure, but something failed. I mean, they should win this game. And it's something that I talked to Matthew Stafford about, because remember when I was with him I spent a lot of time with Matthew Stafford. I asked Matthew Stafford a lot of questions, and that dude did not want to really answer any of them. He was very polite, and he was funny at times, and he was funnier off the record, but he really didn't want to answer them because there's just so much pressure. I mean, one of the things that losing does to you, one of the things that playing for the Detroit Lions does to you, is that you just learn all these ways that a football game can go wrong. And his wife, Kelly Stafford, had told me that, you know, maybe he was lying to himself, thinking that he could turn things around in Detroit. But he entered the season under a certain kind of pressure. And so as my time with him was wrapping up, I did ask him, like, look, if you guys win the Super Bowl, what are you going to do? Is it time to loosen up? Can you finally tell us, you know, what a disaster it was in Detroit? Or that, you know, you were believe you were the best quarterback all along? And he kind of laughed, and he said, you will not be able to find me. And then I drilled down. I was like, no, really? You know, what is going to happen if you win the Super Bowl? What are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to throw my phone in the ocean.
You know what? A parable for what all of us should do if we finally get what we're looking for on this planet, Seth Wickersham. Thank you for taking our call again on ESPN Daily.
My pleasure, man.
And up next, we talk to a man who had as good a view as anyone for the moment that changed both Tom Brady and the NFL forever.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
The question is, did he pull it down? His arm was going forward, but was he throwing a football?
Well, the exact term I can't think of, but if you throw a pass...
So you may remember this guy named Tom Brady. Tall and possibly manicured, possibly immortal, 7 rings, just retired. But as we dive into Super Bowl week in specific, it's worth remembering how that dude's whole deal actually got started. And how it almost, almost never did.
Well, the snow began about 4 this afternoon, but the tailgating began at about 2 o'clock, and the fans are as ready as anyone for this matchup tonight.
This was 20 years ago now. The Patriots were hosting the Raiders at Foxborough for a ticket to the AFC Championship in the painfully bitter cold. And with time winding down in regulation and the Raiders clinging to a 13-10 lead, it happened.
42. Blitz. Lost the football. It's on the ground. Covered by the Raiders.
It was a colossal, game-sealing, career-altering turnover by a quarterback.
His college teammate, Charles Woodson, on the blitz. Tom Brady never sees him coming from the front side.
But then, amid all the chaos of the snow, referee Walt Coleman trundled out to take the microphone in the middle of the field, and everything changed.
After reviewing the play, the quarterback's arm was going forward. It is an incomplete pass. 2nd and 10 on the 42.
Wow.
We now know this event, of course, as the Tuck Rule game. It has been cursed and debated. And yet, as much as it's been seared into the brains of Patriots and Raiders fans for entirely different reasons, the story behind all of it is still worth slicing open, which is what a new 30 for 30 documentary out this week on ESPN aims to do. But I myself wanted to sit down with someone who had a different, up-close and personal vantage point on that moment. Someone who had a 12-year NFL career, including 5 with the Patriots. Someone who wouldn't mind being as honest, maybe, as 2 decades and 1 retirement might now allow. So Damian Woody, you were there. You were there that day. You were on the offensive line, blocking for Tom Brady, trying to save his life. You're now my colleague at ESPN, of course. This game, the Tuck Rule game, was 20 years ago. Does it feel that way to you?
Pablo, it feels like yesterday. It's probably the most important game maybe in NFL history outside of Super Bowl III.
Mm.
That's the importance of that game, because it just – the trajectory that you know, it changed for 2 organizations.
Yeah. I mean, the importance of that moment, this ended up sending Tom Brady and you – and the Patriots to your first Super Bowl. This was sort of the turning point. And I just want to set up what exactly happened there, because you had a vantage point that is rare on this one. So just to set it up briefly, right? Patriots are hosting the Raiders in the AFC divisional round in January 2002. Robert Kraft, the Patriots owner, is insisting that this game be played in Foxborough in all the snow, so there would be this competitive advantage over the West Coast Oakland Raiders. And this film, for the record here, is basically Tom Brady and Charles Woodson, who of course played corner for the Raiders, just rehashing this thing on a huge couch in Tampa.
Wait, what?
If the ball was tucked, look what happened.
All right.
I'd have held onto the ball.
Okay. I'll give you that.
Doesn't take much pressure to knock it out at that point. Go ahead. Fumble. Or in this case, tuck rule.
And so, Damian, I invite you onto the couch here with us, because the Raiders had a 13-3 lead for most of the game. But then the deficit gets narrowed to 13-10, and you're marching down the field, less than 2 minutes to go. What happened next?
So, you know, We broke the huddle and walking up to the line of scrimmage, and I'm sitting there, I'm looking at the defense. You know, I knew by formation, you know, I'm out there pointing out the Mike linebacker. That's what we do in the protection. It was a pass play, obviously. So I'm out there locking my defensive tackle, but it just seemed like this play took forever. And as an offensive lineman, sometimes you have a clock in your head and you're thinking to yourself, why hasn't the ball come out? Because the play itself was designed to be a quick pass play. So the ball is designed to come out quick. And in the moment, I'm thinking, wait a minute, why isn't the ball coming out? And the Raiders did a heck of a job on defense of taking away the first read of Tom Brady. And in that moment, you just heard a big gasp from the whole stadium. Like, and in that moment, everything just, like, time stopped. I turn around in the moment, and I see the ball on the ground. But for some reason, Pablo, I was stuck. Like, it was like I was stuck in time. Mm. Like, my reaction time between when the ball got knocked down to try to recover it, I couldn't move. And that split second that I hesitated allowed Greg Beaker, the linebacker, to recover the ball. And I was sick. I was sick to my stomach knowing that, wow, our season is over with right now. Literally, our season is done.
Wait, so Davian, you jump onto history, basically. And I'm just wondering, like, how long does it take you guys to process whether or not it was a fumble? Like, what cues were you looking at to try and figure this out as you're on the ground in the middle of all of this historical chaos?
I thought it was a fumble. No one really had heard of the tuck rule. Let's just be honest. Nobody heard of the tuck rule. You asked any of my teammates. You asked, definitely talking about the Raiders. They didn't know it. They didn't know a tuck rule existed. So I thought the game was over at that point. And as I'm walking towards the sideline, there's chatter on the sideline. And I'm thinking to myself, what's the big discussion here? Why are people talking on sideline? Like, this is cut and dry. It's a fumble. Game is over. And the chatter just kept building up. And I see Coach Belichick, you know, he's talking. He's animated. And I'm just like, well, why is it taking Walt Anderson so long to declare what the play is? And the longer it took, I'm like, wait a minute, somebody knows something that I don't know. And when Walt Anderson came out and said that Tom Brady's arm was coming forward and it was an incomplete pass, the whole stadium just erupted. People were throwing snow in the air. And the first thing that I did was I looked at the Oakland Raiders sideline and John Gruden. They were all dejected. Done. Mm. And in that moment, I knew we got them. This is it. We have them right here where we want them.
Damian, as you've been telling me this story, your like eyes are wandering. It's almost like you can still feel how cold it was. Like you can still feel every second of what felt like an eternity of that single play.
Absolutely.
Tom Brady himself, Damian, has mentioned that if the Raiders go on to win that game, that he doesn't even think he would be the starting quarterback of the Patriots going forward from that point. Like, can you even process that alternate timeline where, like, Tom Brady doesn't become Tom Brady if not for that particularly insane thing that you were right there for?
It is hard for me to process because I've witnessed his greatness for 22 years now. And to think of a alternate timeline where Tom Brady never exists, it's just unfathomable to me. You know, but when you look at things, you know, in hindsight, think about this. Drew Bledsoe had just signed like this $100 million deal. Like right. He was one of the top highest paid quarterbacks in the National Football League. And if that alternate timeline, people could possibly lay blame on Tom Brady for not having the ball secured in the pocket.
Yep, choker. So, we'd be calling Tom Brady a choker instead of the greatest clutch performer ever.
Yeah, you know, in the moment of truth, you know, he, you know, turned the ball over. So you never know what could have transpired in that situation because, again, Drew Bledsoe was the man in New England at that point.
And now, Damian, we're talking right after Tom Brady has confirmed what we had suspected, that he is finally, officially 100% done with the game of football. How do you consider all of this in retrospect now? How do you consider that guy and the sweep of a career that clearly was singular in sports?
It's unbelievable to think the type of career that Tom Brady has built for himself over a 22-year span. I kind of think about it in this way. You know, I always say every year when a team wins the Super Bowl, there's a couple things have to happen. You absolutely have to be good, and you got to have some plays bounce your way. And when you look at Tom Brady's career in his totality, go back to 2001. Go back to this game. You're talking about something bouncing your way. You had the Tuck rule that literally changed the trajectory of two franchises, not only two franchises, but careers.
Yes.
Tom Brady goes on to win the AFC Championship game, although he got hurt in that game. Then we go on to beat the St. Louis Rams, who were like a 14-point underdog, the greatest show on turf, yep. One of the more improbable wins in Super Bowl history. That just propelled Tom Brady to another stratosphere. But again, it's not just about skill, but you got to have a little luck on your side. And Tom Brady has had that, especially in the early part of his career.
Damien, what would you say to the people who are still complaining that this thing actually was, in fact, a fumble?
Well, listen, in my heart of hearts, was it a fumble? Yes, it was a fumble. If we're looking at it, just pure...
That's so infuriating for so many Raiders fans to hear.
It was a fumble. There's no question in my mind. But, you know, like I had a conversation with my good friend Lincoln Kennedy, who was on the Oakland Raiders at the time. The game wasn't over. The one thing we talked about was you guys still had the opportunity to stop us, but you didn't.
And I'm grateful, Damian, because without the Tuck rule, I don't know if we're working together right now. I don't know if we're sitting in our respective houses thanks to everything that Tom Brady has done for the business of sports gas bagging, incidentally.
Absolutely. Again, it changed the trajectory for so many people. And obviously for myself, you know, I have a couple rings in my safe box right now because of that one play.
Yes, you have a nice bunch of rings, a nice living room I'm staring into right now, Damian Woody. So thank you for taking us back in time.
Thank you.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.